Welcome to the Aquariumax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 81, recorded September 26, 2011. Welcome, everybody. A few weeks ago, John I suggested that we talk about how to stock a 20-gallon saltwater tank. So Brian from Idaho, who has been a regular contributor to the Aquarimax show, has graciously accepted our invitation to be interviewed on this topic. He's been running a 20-gallon nano marine tank for several years, so thank you for joining us today, Brian.
Hi, Russ and Kelly. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, we're pretty excited about this. We don't get to talk about saltwater topics very often, so this should be a lot of fun. We'd like to start out by asking you what your approach or your strategy is for stocking a 20-gallon tank. How do you start? Just let us in on that. How you make those decisions?
Well, personally, I thought about what would keep my family's interest and my interest in watching an aquarium, and about what type of animals I would find interesting for long term. Knowing that there's a possibility some of my fish could live up to 20 years. And once they're in, all the rock work, they're very difficult to get out, so I'm not going to change anytime soon.
Yeah,
that makes sense. It's not easy to move live rock like it is a few pieces of driftwood or something like that without causing some issues.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So, What did you decide would keep the interest of you and your family the best?
Well, having two young kids, fish are always popular. And with the kids, they've got an interesting movement just in the way they swim that is fun to watch. And if you get them the normal commercial size, the possibility is quite high that they'll become a mated pair, and their behavior is interesting that way as well. And contrary to popular opinion, you don't need an anemone for clownfish. You'll find something else in the tank to host in, or just find an area of the tank to call their territory. So I have clownfish, and up until this summer, I had a royal grama. Unfortunately, one night he decided to jump free.
Oh, no.
Most reef tanks don't have a covered top, so he jumped straight out. He was quite crispy before he was found, so he's gone.
No chance for revival.
It takes me months to decide upon a fish that I'll put in my tank, so I haven't replaced it yet.
I guess it's quite a complex sort of dance, deciding what can go in once you've already got a tank stocked, right?
Right. And it all depends upon if your tank is going to be invertebrate-centric or fish-centric, what kinds of corals, crabs, all the little critters you want to keep in your tank. And there's quite a lot of, I think, more decision-making about what your tank can support and what the background animals are going to be, rather than just the fish that you put into it.
Right. Because the ecosystem is quite a bit more complex than that, I guess.
Yeah, it's I think a good way to look at it as a small ecosystem.
Okay, so why don't you tell us about the foundation, the rock work, when you put that in?
The general rule of thumb is still 1 pound of rock per gallon of water. And I have a 20-gallon long, and 20 pounds of rock in a 20-gallon long makes a rock wall, which is fairly ugly to look at. I wanted arches and caves and room for fish to swim and dart in and out. Mm-hmm. So probably two-thirds of the rock that I have is in the sump.
Oh.
And performing biologically, and some of it actually in the sump has coral growing on it. I've got fragments down there under light. And then I can trade or sell them. But up in the display, it's more sparse. And that gives a lot more swimming room, and it's much more interesting to look at than just a rock wall.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So,
I mean, you can have fish that move and swim, and there's some motion and activity.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense. And now with the sump, so you have more gallons actually in the system than you do in the tank itself then?
I don't know exactly, but I probably have 6, maybe 7 gallons extra. I have a 5-gallon tank plus a 5-gallon tank acting as a sump plus a couple of add-ons. And they can hold, hit them with the algae for the refugium and the extra rock. And pumps and heaters and filters and most everything is down below.
Oh, okay. That maximizes the space that you have up in the display portion of the system.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Now, there are lots of different kinds of rock you can do, as I understand it. You can get live rock that's been cured. You can get live rock that's not been cured. You can get base rock that you have to completely cycle yourself. Got different types of live rock from different places like Fiji or Tonga and so on. How did you orchestrate that?
I started with the 10-gallon tank that my wife bought me, actually, and I bought rock that another aquarist was getting rid of. I don't know where it came from. I can tell some of it is old elk horn coral. But other than that, I don't know too much about most of it. I've bought a few pieces here and there from aquarium shops, and I have made a little bit of it out of ragasine and concrete. It doesn't function as well as the natural rock because it's not porous. Hmm. So it only has the surface area on the outside rather than all the surface area on the inside of the porous rock as well.
Right.
But it works as stuff that goes on the bottom that's strong and heavy and stable, and it's not going to move anywhere. So it functions well that way.
So it's more structural than filtrational?
Oh, right, exactly.
I guess I just made up a word, but...
That's okay. It's kind of a specialty of yours.
Yeah. So once you've got the... Now, you mentioned that you like to make archways and caverns and so on with the live rock, and that it was a lot easier when you didn't have to make a whole wall in there. Did you make those based on the existing rock that you had, or are those the bits that you acquired here and there later on?
A little of both. Mostly it's from the stuff I bought initially. It's one large piece of elk horn, which has an interesting shape to it, and then a couple of smaller pieces that just look like interesting rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've stacked them, and for a little more structural stability, you can drill into the rock with a masonry or concrete drill bit and put zip ties through and tie them together. Then they can't get pushed over and knocked over. There's a couple of companies, one in Utah, that make artificial rock. There's one in Florida called Marco Rock, and they mine an old coral bed that's on dry land now in Florida. And so you can buy pieces of rock from them. That's what's called base rock. It's just dried live rock. And it doesn't take much to seed it other than another piece of live rock with supplied sand and thyme.
Okay, so...
Just like in a freshwater tank cycling.
Right, so it's sort of fossilized live rock in a way? But you can still use it. It's not. It hasn't changed its mineral composition or anything. It's just been dead for longer.
Yep, exactly.
Okay.
And I wish I could remember the name of the company in Utah. They use clay and make live rock out of this clay. And so it still has some porous properties. It's not the same clay you can buy to make pottery out of. That has too much silica in it. This is their own recipe, and I've talked to them, and they won't give the recipe away.
Proprietary secret, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
Yep. And they use some foam, and I'm not sure what all else to mix it in, but they've got enough time to work it. And they make interesting shapes. They make bonsai trees and mushrooms and some stuff that's made to look like natural rock, but they put some whimsy into their designs, and they're pretty neat. I'll find that and post it on your Facebook page.
Yeah, that would be great. I'm sure you've piqued a lot of people's interest with that. That it could be fun.
Whimsy is always a good thing.
And then if it's in Utah, maybe we could schedule a visit there or something sometime. That would be nice.
Yeah, that would
be
cool.
A field trip.
I don't know if they'd let us, but they might. You never know.
So when choosing live rock, for two reasons. One, for ease of designing how you want your aquascaping to look, and also pulling live rock from a live reef isn't always sustainable. There are some companies that are doing sustainable harvest, but you're pulling the structure of a living reef out of the ocean if it's not done right. So buying dry base rock is a nice way to go. And then you buy a couple of pieces, maybe one large piece of live rock that you like the look of, and add that to the tank and let it feed the rest. And live rock is expensive stuff. It's about $10 a pound.
Yeah, I remember.
It's heavy, haha.
So a pound isn't all that much.
And if you're buying a base rock, it's cheaper, and without the water in it, it weighs a lot less.
Oh, yeah, I guess I hadn't thought of that, but that makes sense. Yeah, it would be a lot cheaper that way.
Yeah.
Cool. So now that you've got your foundation in there, I guess this is sort of a trick question, but would you pick out your sessile inverts first or your fish?
That is a quick trick question. I guess it comes down to what type of reef do you want? Do you want what are known as SPS or small polyp stony corals? They don't move, but they're very brightly colored, and they take a lot of light to keep alive, a lot of light. But those are the very brightly colored ones that really catch the eye. You want large polyp stony, LPS corals. Not always as brightly colored, although they certainly can be. They take up a lot more space in the tank, but you can have some movement with them as well. Or do you want a soft coral tank? And mine is predominantly soft coral. I have a giant clam and some large polyp stony corals as well. That's a bit of a mix, but mostly soft coral. The soft corals don't have a rigid skeleton, so they move and sway in the current.
Okay.
So I think I would probably start there, although with coral and fish it doesn't necessarily matter. If you're going to get a fish that nips corals, it's going to nip coral regardless.
Okay, so the fish, if it's going to bother corals, it's going to bother corals no matter what type they are.
Most likely. Soft corals might be a little less so, but not always. They can taste a little bad. And then, start looking at your motile invertebrates. Do you want big shrimp or small shrimp? And a very interesting combination for a small tank is a shrimp goby and shrimp pair. And shrimp is blind and it digs a tunnel and it feels the tail of the shrimp goby, the fish, to tell if there is danger outside. And the goby, the fish, gets to use the tunnel that the shrimp makes for protection.
So it's a nice mutualistic association.
Yep. Yeah. And they're small, nice. They're fairly intimate, so with a small tank, you can design it in such a way that you keep them somewhere near the front. You don't get to pick and fit.
Are there things you can do to encourage them to make a burrow near the front?
Just design your rock work in such a way that they can't necessarily get behind it.
Oh, okay.
That'd be about it.
That makes sense. Now,
This
isn't
a commercial, because it's not trying to sell you anything. It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com.
That's why I like getting pairs of a species or a mutualistic association, something that's going to create something dynamic to watch, something interesting to watch.
Now, so you have some soft coral, mostly soft corals, and a few large polyp stonies. Would you mind just sharing some of the species that you have and your experiences with them, or your impressions of them, or you know, what you think about them?
I might have to have pictures to remember what they're called. I have a leather coral. I don't need a book to remember what they're called. That's sad. And I've got a Crocea clam, a tridactid Crocea clam. A toadstool coral. I have zoanthids. What else do I have? I've got to go look at it. Mushrooms. I've got the green star polyps that you and I have talked about on Facebook.
Right.
Some other I don't remember what they're really called. Another zoanthid, a larger one, but it's a right on the edge of my tongue, and I'll know it, remember it a little bit.
Okay.
I've got a Montipora capitata, which is a hard, it's a small polyped coral that makes a plate, and it does better under lower light conditions. I don't have really intense lights. What else do I have in there for corals? I have various algaes that I've put in to look nice, and I think it's a sarcophyton. It's kind of a, everybody that comes and looked at it calls it the tree.
Okay.
Of a pale flesh-colored, tree-shaped branching soft coral. They get about, well, my tank about 5 inches tall, and they have a lot of movement.
Or do they move of their own accord, or are they more subject to the flow of the water?
I think I've got about 2,000 gallons per hour movement in my 20-gallon tank.
Wow.
Yep. Water movement is proving to be as important or maybe more important than the lighting in a tank.
Wow. That's a totally different world from freshwater, definitely. I know I did things to boost water movement when we had our little nano reef tank, but I don't think it was anywhere near that amount of flow. Wow. Now, there are a lot of benefits to the flow. Would you mind just explaining a few of those?
It's nutrient transport. They can't move away from their own waste material. They have to provide water flow to move waste materials away from the coral. They produce a bunch of different chemical compounds in combination with the, you know, the ammonia and phosphates that, everybody gets rid of. They also have some toxins and other things they produce. There's a lot of chemical warfare that goes on amongst the corals in a reef and in a reef tank.
Yeah, I read about that. It seems like it must be hard to keep ahead of that, because they're constantly waging war on one another, but they're also releasing those toxins in such a small water volume that they can poison themselves as well. Is that not the case?
Yeah, to some extent. Mostly, it results in slower growth rates. If they touch each other, then they can damage each other where they touch. Some corals put out a feeding tentacle. It's a feeding tentacle that they put out at night to catch passing prey.
Oh, that's the one that's sometimes called a sweeper tentacle, right?
Yep, exactly, okay. Yeah. And they can have different lengths. And most of those come out at night. So we don't notice them during the day, but the lights go off and the tentacles come out, and they can really pack a powerful sting and hurt their neighbors.
Oh, so they, it's kind of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde sort of thing going on.
Well, to us, I guess, they look nice and pretty, but I think to their neighbors, they never look nice.
Wow.
So that's, thought and planning and, it's with, if you buy the dry base rock, then you can take time and set up the live rock and decide how you want it to look, and you can fill it with fresh water, which adding water to a tank and putting the live rock in can really change how it looks rather than having it just sit in dry. So I recommend doing that. If you use a dry rock that's live, then you have to put salt water in, of course.
Right.
But then you can plan out what type of corals and where you want to put them before you even start.
And would you recommend, if you were to say there are five corals that I'd recommend for a beginner or something like that, are there some good ones that come to mind?
Most any soft coral tends to be easier, and although they tolerate lower light quite well, as a general rule, it's not hard and fast. They do look better with brighter lighting, but they can tolerate lower lighting. So soft corals, mushrooms, and zoanthids, and toadstools, and sarcophytons, and polyphytons. I guess even before you start, just go to the aquarium shop and start looking.
Yeah.
And get an idea of which corals you like and what their light needs are. In a small 20-gallon tank without a whole lot of depth, you can put brighter or more light needing corals at the top and the less light needing ones at the bottom, but it isn't as dramatic if your tank's 2 feet tall or 3 feet tall.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Ophidus, I would say start with the soft corals and the Montiporas and Monte Capitatus and Monte Digitatus. They're some SPS, small polyp stonies, but they're not. They don't need as intensive light. Some people do buy corals, put them in their tanks, let them grow a bit, and then trade them out. And if you plan right, you can do that. I like the look, personally, of a mature reef. So I've tried to take the time and pick what I want and put it in there and just plan on leaving it.
Just letting it spread?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Much
happens.
Yeah. Yeah, we had several different kinds. We had some of the green star polyps and the mushrooms, what else? We had some zoanthids, some what they called Kenyan tree coral, I'm not sure what the scientific name is, that, and what else did we have? Couple more. I noticed our mushroom corals reproduced quite a lot, as did the green star polyps, probably more than any of the others. They both grew kind of like weeds, but it was a lot of fun.
With green star polyps, I would put them on a rock that's isolated in the middle of the sand, so they can only spread so far.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they take over and they'll crawl up other corals, and they can become a nuisance if they're not isolated.
Yeah, I guess. They could become a cnidarian weed. I remember reading an article about how green star polyps used to be very popular as sort of a lawn back 20, 30 years ago or something when they started keeping things like that. They would just have a bare bottom tank and let the star polyps spread all the way along the bottom.
Uh-huh.
So it looked like a lawn. It sounded interesting. I don't know. Probably not as interesting as a reef tank with all sorts of interesting things going on, but better than bare glass.
I thought about doing it still, but I know how it grows up the rock works and it touches too, and I've spent time trying to get rid of it and kill it back, so I don't want to do it again.
Let's see. Well, I was interested by something you said that you don't have super intense lighting, but you do have a tridacnid clam. And how does that work? I understood, and correct me if I'm wrong, that most of the tridacnid clams need all kinds of light. They're very light hungry. So how do you do that?
Well, it was a gift from my wife about 4 years ago. She came home one evening and said, "Look, honey, what I bought you." I've had power compacts since I started, and I thought, oh no, it's going to die. Well, they won't take it back. I might as well put it in. And it is at the very top. I think there might be an inch and a half of water over top of it. And it's in a spot that has water flowing around it, but not directly at it. And it's done fine.
Wow.
Bought it as a little 2-inch, tiny little clam, and now it's about 6 inches.
Wow.
I have fed my tank a lot in the past, but it, dosing it with zooplankton and phytoplanktons. Mostly, I think those just served to follow up my tank and add too much nutrients to the water, and it continues to grow without me feeding it a whole lot. I just make sure it's near the top, getting as much light as it can.
Mm-hmm. So it seems to be getting enough nutrients just from the zooxanthellae that it's hosting?
Mm-hmm. And they provide glucose. They provide the sugar that the clam needs, but they don't provide the rest of the nutrients.
Hmm. So is it just picking up things incidentally that are dissolved in the water? Or?
Yeah, bacteria and other small zooplankton. I have looked under at my tank water under a microscope, and it's full of life.
Okay.
And it filters, I don't remember what filter rate is, but it filters a huge amount of water. So it gets a lot of heat that way.
Hmm.
Evidently, it's doing fine. I haven't, we're 4 years into it, and it's growing.
Wow.
That's cool.
Yeah. And I imagine just being up that high is key. If you were to put it down lower, it probably wouldn't do as well?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Hmm. Let's see. So, I guess we've talked a little bit about water movement. Is you mentioned you... Now, did you say 2,000 gallons per hour?
That's my guess. I think I've got two... there's a propeller pump. I haven't seen them in the freshwater world at all. Kind of like a power head that's turned on its side. And rather than having an impeller, it has a propeller.
Ah, yes, I think I've seen some of those with the... they have the neodymium magnet attachments, things like that.
Yeah,
so you can stick to the side.
It doesn't shoot out a stream of water. It shoots out rather than a jet like a power head does, it shoots out a big stream. And it draws in, that much water as well. So it really moves the water a lot.
Mm. So how many do you need in your tank to do that, or do you just have one?
I have two. I think they're 900 gallons apiece.
Wow.
And I've got them situated in such a way that there's some random currents and movement and motion. If I had a bigger sump or a bigger tank, I might... I'd like to use a closed-loop system. I think they do a little better job of keeping the water movement going. And a big part of it is it just picks up the detritus and keeps it suspended until it can go through the overflow and get trapped. I use a filter sock.
Okay.
It gets trapped in the filter sock.
And so that doesn't end up settling on corals or getting in corners and rotting or things like that?
It tends to get into corners and under things, and that's where my vacuuming it once every couple of weeks comes in when I do my water changes. As far as detritus settling on the corals, that tends to be a good thing, and they'll happily eat it.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, stirring up the water isn't a bad thing.
Okay. Now, I was going to ask about a protein skimmer. I know that some people say you need one on any size system. Others say on a small system, if you're doing enough water changes, you really don't need it. And there seems to be a lot of debate about that. What's your take on a protein skimmer for a tank of that size?
You don't have to have one on any size tank, but boy, do they make life easier.
So do you have one on that one?
Yeah, I've always had one.
Okay.
I use CPR. I don't remember the CPR stands for. It's the company name, CPR Aquatics. I use their backpack. It's a pretty simple. It's older technology, nothing fancy. But it does a fairly good job for a 20-gallon tank. Might use it up for a 30-gallon. I think mine is rated up to a 60-gallon tank, but I wouldn't use it for any more than about a 30-gallon.
Better safe than sorry.
It does a good job.
Mm-hmm.
It helps keep the water a lot cleaner. Yes, it pulls out extra stuff when they should. That's why you do your water changes, to put those salts and nutrients and stuff back into the water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like it just makes, like you say, it makes life easier from what I've been able to tell, because you don't have to worry about all of those nitrogenous compounds and everything building up, and it kind of captures them before they have to be taken care of by bacteria and so on. Is that kind of how it works?
Yeah, exactly. And when you see, so the proteins and amino acids and nitrogenous compounds, they have an affinity to the surface tension of air and water. So a skimmer uses the propeller, and there's so many different ways it's done now. It's not worth going into in a short amount of time.
Right.
They create very tiny, small bubbles by the, who knows how many, in the skimmer. And so those compounds have an affinity and attraction to those small bubbles, and they stick to them, and they go to the top, and they build and foam and get collected into a cup that sits on the top. And you pour out half a cup worth of pea-colored water from your tank, just knowing that that much is leaving. I don't think I would go back to water changers only. I only did it for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
That just makes the filtration that much easier.
Yeah.
On top of the protein skimmer, I've also got an algae scrubber, a filter sock, and I use the bio pellets on top of the 20 pounds of live rock and the live sand.
Wow. And is it, the algae scrubber, is that when you have a refugium with algae that is on an opposite light cycle from the rest of the tank, and so the algae is doing its growing during the night when the tank's not illuminated?
Ideally, that would be the case, but I've got mine in the sunshine.
Ah.
So mine's on a day cycle. I have my refugium, which is full of live rock and coral, on the opposite cycle, so that happens there.
Okay.
But my algae sits in the sunshine.
Okay.
And even with the biopellets and the protein skimmer and all the live rock, the algae grows like crazy.
Wow.
So I pull it out and put a little back in and throw the rest into my compost pile and know that it's sitting in there doing its job. And the algae plays host to lots of small detritus-eating invertebrates. So there's a little bit more refugium action going on there.
Mm-hmm. So you've got the ubiquitous pods in there?
Yep, the amphipods and copepods.
Mm-hmm.
Pod people.
Yeah, we always had fun with those. My kids were as fascinated with the little amphipods and copepods and whatnot, just as much as they were with the feather duster worms or the anemone fish or whatever. So they loved it.
And that's the cool thing about having a nano tank, because you can get really close to it. Most people that come over and look at the tank get within about a foot of it, and sit there looking close.
Yeah, I realize that's mostly what we did too, because then you could see the little snails and all sorts of things.
Well, my two-year-old just walked in.
She want to say hi on the show?
You want to say hi?
Hi.
Okay, bye-bye, Brooke.
Our youngest guest on the show so far.
Yeah.
Wow. I guess we're kind of running low on time. But I wonder if you would, before we go, if you would tell us a little bit more about some good fish. You can put it in a nano.
If it's a reef tank, then I went through one of my books today and narrowed it down to, I think, nine different classes of fish. I guess we'll say they're not really a genus or species. They're picked out the clownfish, brahmas, bodybacks, damselfish, bowies, pipefish, which are kind of like a long, skinny seahorse, seahorses, cardinal fish, and dark fish or five fish. There are a lot of fish in those names that are appropriate size-wise for a 20-gallon tank. There's a lot more that needs to go on when you're looking at them. Like the dotty backs tend to be aggressive. Some fish become really territorial, and grandmas are very shy, really pretty, but very shy, so they tend to flip from rock hiding spot to rock hiding spot. You don't get to watch them out in the open very often, so you see them flitting back and forth in the rock work. If you want to go with something that doesn't have as much rock work, but more seagrasses or algaes, and you have a taller tank, you can get seahorses.
That would be neat.
I love seahorses. I've had a soft spot for them ever since I was old enough to know what they were.
I think my next take is going to be a seahorse and pipefish tank.
Wow.
Ooh.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back on for that one.
Well, I've got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, so I think it'll be a while.
Oh, they'll love it. They'll call it the ponyfish tank.
Well, my son, when he was about a year and a half, called horses foo-foos.
Okay.
So we've got fishy foo-foos.
Love it. That's cute.
So in my tanks, I've had the clownfish, and I've had royal grama, which head is a royal purple, and about midway through the fish, it fades into yellow for the tail. There's a lot of different gobies. There's one called a Rainsford goby, which is small, about an inch and a half long, and they hunt through the rockwork, and they're fun to watch. There are other fish that look like they would be appropriate. One in particular is the six-line wrasse. And they're green and purple and absolutely beautiful. But they get bored in a 20-gallon tank, and they look like they're just going to go out of their minds with boredom. Even though size-wise, and every book I've ever read says they're appropriate for a 20-gallon tank. I had two die because they look like they just died from not being able to hunt enough.
That's sad.
So the fish never read the books that said that it was appropriate in a 20-gallon tank, I guess.
And if you've got a fish-only tank, there are some small angels that would work in a 20-gallon. You could do a fish-only with shrimp. They all fall into the central hyphae genus. And the two common ones are the flame angel and the potter's angel. They're absolutely beautiful.
Oh, yes, I remember.
They eat clams and they eat coral.
I remember the flame angels from Hawaii when we were there. I would see them once in a while, and they were amazingly beautiful.
Yep, those are the guys.
Yeah,
and also in Hawaii are the hawkfish, and there are some hawkfish that would do very well in a 20-gallon tank. They eat small invertebrates and fish.
They're really bad on shrimp, are they not?
Yeah, they love shrimp.
Yeah, that's what I think I remembered from that, yeah. But those are the ones that perch up on a high piece of coral or rock or something, and they sort of survey everything and then dive down and grab things?
There's no motion at all except for their eyes, which never stop moving.
Weird.
Is that why they call them hawkfish? Because they pick a high vantage point and then just dive down?
Oop, yeah. They're cool. It would be fun to have one in a small tank, in a medium-sized tank. But if you want to have any smaller fish, Larson and Dernovitz can't get a hot fish.
Not going to work. Well, it sounds like there's so much that we could never cover it all in one episode or 10 episodes. But I think this has been a great introduction to what to do with 20-gallon saltwater tank.
Well, I hope that helps give some direction for thinking about where do you start when you're thinking about stocking a small tank.
Right.
And, you know, if you talk to the guys in the fish store, they won't usually tell you that you really need to wait 3 months, 6 months before you put a fish in.
Wow.
They're not going to want to tell you that. But these tanks, especially if you start out with dry rock, take so long to build up their bacterial colonies that you really need to wait. Putting in something like an anemone or a clam, it's a year minimum. You don't put them in for a year.
Wow. But everybody thought it took so long to cycle a freshwater tank.
Yeah.
Nothing happens fast in an aquarium, especially a saltwater aquarium. Nothing good happens fast.
Wow. And I guess that's why they don't want to say it, because it's against the business model, even though it makes the best husbandry sense. It makes it really hard
now
for them to sell things. Yeah.
Yeah.
People would say, well, I'm not going to get a saltwater tank then, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of shops that I've been to, and the ones that I tend to patronize, that do say that.
Mm-hmm.
They get the loyal customers and the people that are actually going to spend $80 on a fish.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not going to come back and spend another $80 on another fish if the first one dies in 3 days.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we need more shops like that that are willing to just give you the truth, even if it hurts. Yeah. Well, thank you once again, Brian. We're very glad that you joined us and helped give us such a great glimpse into the world of saltwater. And we hope to have you back to talk about all kinds of things in the future.
Well, thanks. It's always fun to share. This is my hobby and my passion. I'll have to talk about it with anybody that'll listen.
Well, now you have a nice captive audience.
Yeah, so we'll definitely have it back then.
Sounds good. And if anybody has any questions that they want to put on your Facebook page, I check it occasionally, and you can always send them to me by email as well, and I'll answer as I can.
Sure.
Great.
Yeah, we'd love to do that. Okay. Well, may the fish be with you.
Thanks. I love you too.
Good
night,
Brian.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com.
For comments and/or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.